Pre-recorded, completely unscripted, and about as organised as the thought processes of some members of the Australian Senate, you're listening to news, views and opinions on events from here at home and around the globe on politics, business and society in general. This is the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove.
Welcome back, dear listener. We're up to episode 65. It's the 5th of October, 2016. I'm back from yet another holiday. I've returned refreshed. And Scott, well done for holding the fort in my absence.
Thank you very much, Trevor. It was okay. Yeah, it wasn't too bad.
That's good. No, you did a great job.
Did you have a good holiday?
I did, and
that's good.
You know, when you're on holiday, you get a bit of time to sort of spend more time maybe on Facebook and stuff like that than you ordinarily would, because you just got time to kill at different times. Mind you, I was working as well, but I collected a mountain of articles, Scott, in the 2 weeks since we last spoke. I know that. I will often trot out maybe 10, maybe 12 or something like that each week. And this week, when I sent you the list, I think we had about 30 to 40 of them.
We've got 3 or 4 weeks worth there.
We do. So you were a little bit worried by the length of it.
I took your advice. I just did the first, I think I've got 12 read.
Okay.
I've got the first 12 read.
You've done a job. With a real job, you've managed to also, you know, do this sort of nonsense at the same time. So good on you, Scott. So, I'm going to kick off. I'm not sure if I mentioned this to you on the running sheet, but Satanic Temple. I've been threatening for a while, Scott. And
to set up an Australian chapter.
I think we need to. Dear listener, you've got to join me with this. I've sent my application off. I emailed the Satanic Temple. And I said, I thought I had an impressive CV for an application for the Satanic Temple. I said, well, I've been doing a secular podcast for 64 weeks and spokesperson for the secular party and blah, blah, blah. I mean, how many people would have those qualifications when writing to them? So we'll see what they say. That was about 2 or 3 days ago, no response, but maybe they're just quietly checking us out, Scott. So we'll see. But anyway, I'll keep you informed, dear listener, because I am very keen. As you know, religious instruction classes in Queensland, they have a right, religions, to go in to the schools, government schools, taxpayer-funded schools, Scott, and Bible-bash the kids with religious nonsense. Yet if you wanted to present a ethics class, you don't have the right to. And I just think, I've got a funny feeling that the Satanic Temple of Australia, if it was doing some sort of religious instruction class, would be heavily weighted towards an ethics-type class. And I see it as a way of getting that in to the kids and offering an alternative. And, you know, could you imagine turning up at a school in the leafy western suburbs that's currently got some sort of evangelical Baptist going in, and we're out the front with our Satanic Temple leaflets offering satanic instruction. If that doesn't get some mainstream press, I don't know what will. People saying, oh, what are the Satanists up to? This is terrible. And then, you know, explain what we're actually doing. They'll go, well, maybe that's not so bad. So,
yeah, exactly.
So
yeah.
I think I could have a lot of fun with that. So, anyway, dear listener, I've sent off, you know, a little request, and we'll see what happens. We'll keep you informed, but you heard it here first. And I'll be looking for participants, people willing to join the cause. So that's that. You know, Scott, it could be a little bit, we're a bit fortunate. Our timing is fortunate if we are to set up some sort of satanic temple, because right at this moment, worldwide, there's an emergency need for exorcists after a surge in people dabbling in Satanism and black magic.
Well, I would just like to know who it was that said that it's an emergency out there, and, you know, what are his or her qualifications to call it an emergency? And when I went through, I was looking through, and I thought to myself, yeah, this sounds okay. Dr. Cascoli teaches
courses in exorcism at the Pontifical University of Regina. I can't say that word. Apostolorum, a Vatican-backed university in Rome.
That's right.
You know, so that's who's calling this an emergency, and he's saying that he needs all these extra exorcists.
This isn't some crazy Baptist church in Nowheresville, USA. This is a group, you know, backed by the Vatican, no less.
It might be backed by the Vatican, but they're still lunatics. I mean, it's...
they are, you know. But let's just give a bit more to the dear listener. So, according to this article, exorcists are in urgent demand as a result of a sharp rise in people dabbling in Satanism and the occult, experts from the Catholic Church in Italy and the US said. Speaking in tongues, levitating and vomiting nails may seem far-fetched to most people, but church experts insist.
Far-fetched to me, yes.
Church experts insist there is a need to recruit more priests as exorcists in order to combat sorcery and black magic. Yes, so you mentioned Walter Cascioli, psychologist and scientific consultant to the International Association of Exorcists, which is endorsed by the Vatican, described it as an emergency, the lack of priests capable of fighting the forces of evil. There you go, potential satanic temple members. There's a bit of an opening here for us. He told La Stampa newspaper, there's a pastoral emergency as a result of significant increase in the number of diabolical possessions that exorcist priests are confronting. Oh, dear. He teaches that course that you mentioned. He says, it's dangerous to underestimate a phenomenon that is caused by the direct actions of the devil, but also by a decline in faith and values. He called for the establishment of a permanent training college or university where Catholic priests would be taught how to counter the malign influence of the devil. Oh, we need an interdisciplinary approach in which science collaborates with religion and psychiatrists work with demonologists and exorcists. Well, if those groups can get together, they might have us. But I'm feeling confident that we're safe from their clutches.
I'm finding it ridiculous that he mentioned science and that sort of stuff in the same word, in the same sentence, where he then went off and said, you know, with scientists collaborates with religion and psychiatrists work with demonologists and exorcists. You know, I find that ridiculous that he would mash those all up into one sentence and carry on with it.
Well, he's building himself up as, you know, a legitimate practitioner of a legitimate science. So, we've got another character here. We've got a
This is the guy from the US.
Ildebrando Di Fulvio. He's the exorcist for the Diocese of Frosinone, a town south of Rome. Said people possessed by the devil often vomited metal objects and chunks of undigested food and gibbered in archaic languages such as Aramaic, Ancient Greek and Latin. Scott, I'm a bit worried that perhaps I might be possessed, because his next sentence here, they demonstrated violent reactions to prayers of liberation and to holy water. I think I might demonstrate a violent reaction. Oh, and there's a guy in San Jose, California, ordained priest for 22 years. In the past 10 years, he has performed 50 to 60 exorcisms. He says, I'm a full pastor, and this is a very intense ministry. Almost every free night that I have is taken up with exorcisms. Oh, for goodness sake.
So how long does an exorcism take? I mean, it's if he's getting through 50 to 60 in 10 years, that's 5 or 6 a month.
Well, not to be underestimated how difficult it is, Scott.
Yeah.
So there we go. Satanic Temple could have a free ride because all the exorcists are pretty busy at the moment. Now, just to sort of spread the love here, I thought I'd quickly look up what Islam had to say on Satan. Scott, and from the Hadith, this one, on Satan, and this would be from Sahih Muslim, would be the reference, MO235044, for those who are interested and want to look it up, said Muhammad, if someone drops food from his mouth, he should quickly pick it up, brush off any dirt, eat it, and never leave any for Satan. That's the advice from Satan. And
from Muhammad, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Someone mentioned to Muhammad a man that slept long after sunrise. Muhammad said, Satan has urinated in that man's ears. Muhammad said, when a person is born, Satan touches him with two fingers. Jesus, Mary's son, was the exception. Satan tried to touch him, but missed and touched the placenta instead. And finally, just because it's totally unrelated, but I was just flicking through the book at the time and I had a little note on it. Scott, just to work out whether you've got the criteria to be a prophet, Muhammad said, there are five things that prophets have in common. Circumcision, shaved pubic hair, plucked armpits, a closely trimmed moustache, and trimmed fingernails. I'm good for two out of five. I'm not saying which ones.
Yeah, I got trimmed nails, but that's about it. So, yeah.
So that's Satan. Everyday Western life, still fascinated with Satan. Scott, Queensland, back home, abortion law reform, that bill that was quite clumsy that Rob Pine put through, didn't get through, and he's drawn up this replacement bill, which is a little bit more nuanced than the previous one, and that's currently under discussion in Queensland. There's a link on the website. You can make a submission by the 6th of October if you're in favour of the bill. You could do that, which would be a good idea, dear listener, because I can assure you the ACL and its various entities are busily sending emails and garnering their people to object to this legislation. So, yeah. So this one's sort of as of right, abortions up to 24 weeks, allows some conscientious objection by doctors and creates patient protection safe zones around abortion facilities. So that's in the wings in Queensland. We'll see if that comes through. But meanwhile, Scott, in Poland, they've turned around and passed a bill.
Yeah, I couldn't believe this when you sent this to me.
Going the other way. So last Friday, 267 members of Poland's parliament, the lower house, voted in favour of a bill that would change the law to make terminations only if the mother's life was at risk and to increase the maximum jail term for abortionists from 2 years to five. So they're going backwards in Poland. And it says here that it would make women who have had an abortion liable to prison terms, although judges would have discretion to waive individual sentences. This is from Catholic News. No prizes for guessing. The proposed bill has received the backing of the church, although bishops have opposed the jailing of women, but in a concession from the bishops.
Yeah, but, you know, it's... You read further on and it says the measure would make it illegal to freeze embryos, which proponents say are human beings from the moment of fertilisation.
Mm.
It would also only allow women to fertilise one egg at a time. Mm. So they've got this... it's the whole Catholic agenda, isn't it? They've got this opposition to... Oh, what's the word I'm groping for? To fertility treatments and that sort of stuff.
Mm.
And then they've wrapped it all up there and doing away with abortion also. I find it incredible.
Can I mention a group that will surprise you who are more progressive on this sort of thing than the Catholic Church? ISIS.
Yeah.
As devout followers of Islam, the position of Islam on embryos is quite interesting, Scott. Have you heard what it is before?
I have heard that they don't believe that the soul inhabits the life form until it's actually born.
Close. So,
yeah, okay.
120 days, roughly.
Right.
According to Islamic doctrine. So pretty much they consider that a fetus is not a human being until about 120 days. So I was listening to it.
4 months.
Yeah. So, you know, technically an Islam or, you know, an ISIS follower could be conducting embryonic research. They wouldn't have a problem with that. Just quoting, this is from an article, just quoting the Hadith, again, from Bukhari, number 3036. Those of you at home looking up your own personal hadith can check this out. Each one of you is constituted in the womb of the mother for 40 days, and then he becomes a clot of thick blood for a similar period, and then a piece of flesh for a similar period. Then Allah sends an angel who is ordered to write four things. He is ordered to write down his deeds, his livelihood, his date of death, and whether he will be blessed or wretched in religion. Then the soul is breathed into him. At that point, you're a human being. But there you go.
Yeah, okay.
It's interesting that it's all preordained, isn't it?
That's what they certainly... That's certainly what they teach you anyway in the religions, is that it's preordained. Mm. You know what you are and that sort of stuff is all preordained.
Mm. The angel is
I find bizarre.
Mm. The angel is going to write down your deeds, your livelihood, your date of death, and whether you'll be blessed or wretched in religion. So it's all mapped out in front of you. So much for choice. Scott, there's been a lot of talk about school funding. With private schools?
Yes, there has been. Mm. And that's because Simon Birmingham has broken with the pack and came out there and said the unsayable. He has said that a number of high-fee private schools are receiving taxpayer funding almost three times greater than their entitlements.
Mm.
Yeah.
So he has got good traction. That's been quite well sort of put out in the news.
It has been, yeah, absolutely. You know, it's it is ridiculous that, you know, you've got the example they go to, Loreto Kirribilli, an elite Catholic girls' school charging almost $19,000 a year in fees for senior students, received 283% of its funding entitlement, making it the most overfunded school in the country.
Mm.
Anyway, so you read down further, and it says. The Gillard government's Gonski reforms, while offering more money to needing schools, had locked in the problem by guaranteeing no school would be worse off and offering private schools generous indexation rates. That was the problem with Gonski, is that they went through and said no school will be worse off, and they have locked in this ridiculous overfunding for schools that frankly can afford to stand on their own two feet. And, you know, if Loreto Kirribilli can't survive by charging 19 grand a year, well, maybe it shouldn't survive. You know.
I agree. Like, you know, the people in charge of, or in favour of, the government providing funds for private school say that, well, private school parents pay their taxes, and so if they want to pay a bit extra towards their school, then they should be able to. So they should be able to, you know, because they pay taxes, there should be government money, and if they want to pay extra because they love their children so much, then they should be able to. But it doesn't quite work out that way, because, I mean, an analogy would be that... you know, we've got a public transport system, you know, buses. And if a group of people said, you know what, we want our own private bus, just like a fancy one, and we would like the government money, you know, that it costs for an average bus, and then we'll pay the extra for a nice bus. That's not how an efficient system works. What people have to realise is this funding of private schools only started in the Whitlam era. It's, you know, prior to that...
It started with Menzies.
Just
with
prior, era. Yes.
Yeah.
Just prior to Whitlam. Menzies in a very minor way, Gough in a more specific way, and then got completely out of control with John Howard, where he just took it to another level. And historically, people just don't understand that prior to that time, for most of our history, the government was not providing money for private schools.
No, they weren't.
And, in fact, overseas, it's extremely rare to provide money for private schools, and you would never do it where you just provide money and let them do whatever they like with the money. Like, if they do get it, it's certainly tied to certain things. So we're completely out of whack with our own history and with the rest of the world, and they're not... You know, the other thing is they're not saving the community money by providing their own contribution to school fees, because the private schools reject or don't even get applications from the needy, the disadvantaged, the people who need extra help, and also they're not in remote areas. So it's a lot easier to... and a lot cheaper to educate children if you're just going to take the easy ones in metropolitan areas and ignore the difficult ones in remote areas. So they're actually just taking the easy stuff and leaving the hard stuff for the public sector. And Scott, it's just the division that these schools create. Like our whole immigration problem, where we're saying we're worried about, you know, Muslims coming into Australia and how are they going to integrate into our community? And, well, if we send them off to their own private little school in grade one and keep them separate from the community for 12 years, why would we be surprised?
They're going to be separated from the sexes, are going to be separated, all that sort of stuff throughout their whole education.
Yep.
It's going to end up ridiculous that they'll end up at 17 not ever having... cross paths with the members of the opposite sex,
There's a really interesting podcast on This American Life where it talked about forced integration in America and, you know, from the heyday of sort of equal rights activism, it's sort of disappeared where they were bussing kids across town.
Yes, I remember that, yes.
And putting them in different schools. But there was a recent case where... A predominantly, well, it was a, you know, a 99.9% black school was performing so badly that it actually lost its registration and could no longer operate as a school. And as a result, the black kids were then sent off into white schools. And really interesting story. And, you know, the reporter's upshot of the whole thing is that when you put the disadvantaged into those sorts of mainstream white schools, then it actually helps them to catch up education-wise, and it's not to the detriment of the existing kids. It's just a win-win situation. So there's a whole host of reasons why we should not be funding private schools, and we should be making it bloody difficult for private religious schools to operate. And... and it's had a bit of attention this week, Scott. And that's one of the main platforms of the Secular Party, dear listener. If you don't like all those comments, don't vote for us. But if you think there's a skerrick of truth in there, then throw us a vote at the next election.
It is ridiculous. I mean, I grew up all my life in private schools and that sort of stuff. And, you know, now as I look back on it and that type of thing, I think to myself, yeah, Mum and Dad really were wasting their money. You know, it really was... unnecessary, and it didn't achieve anything or anything like that. I would have still ended up probably in the same place where I was if I'd gone to the local state school.
I went to a very poor private Catholic school, and I look at my kids who went to government high schools, and I'm just jealous of the opportunities and education they got. So so anyway, that's private
schools. That was before Gonski too.
Was. That's right. With the, and I've told the story of the high jump on the traffic island. That's how poor we were. Yeah.
Yes, you did. Yes.
Scott. Chess. Do you play chess?
I do play chess, yes. Do you? I'm not very good at it, but I do play chess, yeah.
Hmm.
I'm not going to be going off and joining these people in Iran, though. But, no. You know,
so. So the story, dear listener, is, you know, in the World Championship of Female Players of Chess, the organising committee has made the decision to hold the event in Iran, of all places. And by the way, competitors, it will be compulsory. You'll need to wear a hijab when you're playing. This is from people around the world. What a disgrace.
It was a disgrace, wasn't it? You know, sorry, I've cut you off. Keep going.
You know, these people will be arrested if they don't wear a hijab.
Yeah.
US women's champion Natsi Pagitsi said, "It's completely unacceptable to host one of the most important women's tournaments in a venue where to this day women are forced to cover up with a hijab." Meanwhile, from the organising committee, American Grandmaster Susan Polgar said, "Players just need to respect cultural differences."
I had to read that a second time. I thought to myself, what the hell is she saying that for?
Yes.
You know, I personally would have no issues with wearing the headscarf as long as it is the same to all players.
Yes.
I mean, for God's sake, does she not realise that men are not required to wear a hijab? It's only it's only a requirement for women to wear a hijab?
Yes.
You know, it's absolutely infuriating that someone, you know, it was like that author said, you know, it's this cultural relativism. Mm. It's gone mad. It really has gone mad. That someone, and you know, you've got to be smart to get that high up in chess.
You would think so.
Well, you do have to be smart to get that that good in chess. You have to be very smart.
Mm.
But for her to then come out and say that, I found it ridiculous. Mm. I found it infuriating, and it was really offensive to women. You know, I thought that the US women's champion was bang on the money. She said it's absolutely unacceptable to host one of the most important women's tournaments in a venue where, to this day, women are forced to cover up in a hijab. You know, she's right. She's bang on the money. It's crazy that they've gone and done that.
Mm.
Yeah.
Anyway. I mean, this respecting other cultures argument might be fine if you were voluntarily visiting a country. Like, you know, if you're, as a tourist going to go to Iran, then you're going to just have to expect to wear the hijab.
Yeah, you are. You know, but, you when in Rome, you've got to do what the Romans
do. But these players are not going voluntarily. They just want to participate in the tournament, and they're having to go where the tournament is held. So for that reason, they don't have a choice. So in that situation, the organisers are under a duty when choosing a venue not to subject them to abuse, and forcing somebody to wear a hijab when they don't want to is a form of abuse.
Exactly. Yeah, it really is. Yeah. Mm.
The other thing this lady said, Scott, was that when I visit different places with different cultures, I like to show my respect by dressing up in their traditional style of clothing. No one asked me to do it. I just do it out of respect. And I hear that and I go, that's cultural appropriation. Well, it is, you know, if you're so, you know, from the regressive left, that would be the other argument from our friend at the Brisbane Writers Festival would say, what?
It would be, yeah.
You get dressed up in their traditional style of clothing, that's a cultural appropriation.
Yeah.
You can't do that. You can't win. But anyway, so I feel sorry for the chess players and that they've got such a pathetic organising committee who's done that. We'll see what happens. From the Australian Independent Media Network, an article entitled "The Insidious Influence of the Church on the State."
Yeah, that was really interesting, wasn't it?
Hmm. And a couple of things it says. What you really need to understand is going on with churches and politics is you've got to focus on the money. And then there's two aspects to the money. One is that churches are obviously getting tax-free income. And the second is that they just get a flood of public cash through their coffers as they provide faith-based delivery of public services, you know, like healthcare and all the rest of it. So the money is simultaneously enriching the religious groups, and it's also silencing them because they got a lot of money and a big business that's now reliant on getting money from the government. So their ability to be true advocates for the poor or others is actually compromised because of all the money they're taking from the government. And the most interesting thing for this article was the bit about Cardinal Pell. So this is something...
Yeah, it was, wasn't it? Yeah.
That he had said back in 2004, which I'd never heard of, where he weighed in on the carbon tax debate. So this is Cardinal Pell. Some of the hysteric and extreme claims about global warming are also a symptom of pagan emptiness, of Western fear when confronted by the immense and basically uncontrollable forces of nature. In the past, pagans sacrificed animals and even humans in vain attempts to placate capricious and cruel gods. Today, they demand a reduction in carbon dioxide emissions.
The difference is we've got 97% of climate scientists are saying that carbon dioxide is bad, and you've got approximately 0% of scientists who claim that sacrificing anything will help assuage the gods, you know?
I mean, if there weren't enough reasons to despise Cardinal Pell...
I mean, it's ridiculous, wasn't it?
Add that to the list.
You know, yeah, exactly. You know, he's... Anyway, we'll have to see where the Royal Commission goes with that. But Pell's under investigation now, currently, isn't he?
Yes, as to his how much he knew and whatever. So
exactly.
All right. It hasn't been a good week for Donald Trump, Scott.
No, it hasn't, has it?
No. It's been a great week for everyone else, but a bad week for Donald Trump because he actually entered a debate with Hillary Clinton and came out worse for wear by the end of it. A really good satire was done by Saturday Night Live. Did you see that?
No, I haven't seen that. No.
Dear listener, like Google Alec Baldwin and Donald Trump, you know, satire video or whatever, and it is hilarious. So...
I'll have a look at it.
Baldwin's dressed up as Trump. He's got the hairstyle, he's got the mouth actions, he's got the arrogance down pat, and then there's a blonde lady who's not really trying to caricature Hillary Clinton as much, but, you know, it's sort of a mock going over of the debate. It's very, very funny. And one part of it, the Hillary Clinton says... you know, Donald Trump hasn't released his tax returns, which means either he's not that rich, and Donald Trump interrupts saying wrong, and she says, or he's not that charitable, and the Donald Trump interrupts and says wrong, and then she says, or he hasn't paid tax in his life, and the Donald Trump character says, warmer. And he goes on with a big rant about something, and the moderator says to her, so what do you think of that? And she says, I think I'm going to be the next president of the United States. It's very, very funny. But the part I like, so it's came out that in his 1995 personal tax filing, Donald Trump used aggressive accounting tactics and claimed a loss of $916 million. And that was published in, it might be New York Times. Yes, New York Times. And Donald Trump has not denied this. And accountants like yourself over there, Scott, are saying, well, it probably means he's never paid tax since then because of the size of the loss he's had. And the way things can carry forward. He probably hasn't paid tax since 1995.
I think that's probably right. I mean, you're talking about the better part of $1 billion. It was written off in 1995. You'd think to yourself, what's he worth? About $1 billion. You know, he's probably got 20 years worth of tax losses there.
So he hasn't denied it was leaked, and it all seems to be true. And the veracity of the document was confirmed by Trump's former accountant, Jack Mitnick, who told the paper he could remember it because he had to manually input the figure in question because tax preparation software did not allow for nine-digit losses.
Yeah, I mean, there's this final paragraph here. That being said, Mr. Trump has paid hundreds of millions of dollars in property taxes, sales and excise taxes, real estate taxes, city taxes, state taxes, employee taxes and federal taxes, along with very substantial charitable contributions. That may be the case. I don't have a problem. Me and my better half were having a discussion about this last night, and I still don't have a problem if you've got a hell of a lot of losses that you write off in 1 year that then carry forward for, you know, in this case, 20 years.
Yep. I don't have a problem either.
One thing my better half did say, though, he said, wouldn't you think if you were running for president, though, you wouldn't claim those carried forward losses for 2 years, so you then had 2 years worth of income tax returns that showed you actually paid income tax?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, it was just a last-minute decision, I bet, but...
well, it probably was a last-minute decision for him to run,
So, I don't have a problem with him carrying forward his losses. It's just that don't run for president and claim to be for the poor working man and all the rest of it.
No, and that is exactly right, you know, because, you know, there were all sorts of cases in there where you had... where I forget who it was, I think it might have been Hillary, where she said, you know, you don't claim to be for the working man and that sort of stuff and then not pay any tax.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. It just goes to show how credulous some of these Americans are to think that a guy like Donald Trump is going to be, who's done nothing for poor working class people, is suddenly their champion and they're believing it.
That's the thing that I find incredible is that, you know, you've got a man that has made a fortune off the... you know, off the work of poorer people and that sort of stuff.
Yep.
And he has not done anything out of the ordinary to help them. You know, he's probably paid the minimum he can get away with paying people. You know, there's talk of him not paying contractors and that sort of stuff for businesses that folded and that type of thing. It's and yet he's come out now and he's pitching to the poorer people that he's some kind of miracle worker that's going to return your jobs and all that sort of stuff. I find it really bizarre that he's gone as far as he has with that line.
That he's got their interests at heart. It's just amazing that they... Well, I've got a theory about that. I'll talk about it later as to why...
Yeah, no worries.
...why they believe him. Still on America, article here just talking about how tough life is in the United States. 2014 report from Economic Policy Institute reported that of 26 nations, the US had the lowest paid work in the OECD, as well as the highest incidence of that lowest paid work. The minimum wage here is $7.25 an hour, that's the US, and there are 35 million Americans, or a quarter of the workforce, who work for less than $10.55 an hour. Goes on to say that things are slightly cheaper in America and you've got an exchange rate, but it's a diabolical situation for a lot of Americans over there. And that's the neoliberalism experiment being conducted, and it doesn't look good for a lot of the population.
Well, I found it incredible that you had an American piece entitled 20 Ways to Help Your Employees Struggling with Food Insecurity.
Yes.
I mean, for God's sake, if you've got someone working for you full-time, they ought to be able to put a roof over their head and put a meal on the table. They mightn't be able to afford to have a holiday and that sort of stuff, but they ought to be able to. They ought to be able to have the basics. And you've got this situation that you've got a thing, 20 ways to help your employees struggling with food insecurity.
Mm.
I find that incredible. And, you know, it's absolutely ridiculous that the guys that are sitting on millions and millions at home don't pay their workers a living wage.
Mm. They don't have to. There's no collective bargaining forcing them to. So while they can, they will refuse to. So,
it was written up here, you know, in the 1980s, US governments decided to accept high levels of unemployment as a favour to business, drive down wages and encourage competition amongst the unemployed workers for low pay. You know, in Australia, the Hawke-Keating Accord was a bargain struck between unions and government, and the unions agreed wage restraints in return for the state's provision of a social wage, Medicare, accessible higher education, family tax benefits, and the superannuation scheme. I find that ridiculous that our current government is eyeing off certain sections of that social wage. They are concentrating on attacking welfare recipients and that sort of stuff.
Mm.
As opposed to trying to find their savings elsewhere.
Well, it's all the influence of the Institute of Public Affairs and the other neocons that are in that Turnbull government. So, yes, when you hear their theories, think about America, where those theories have been applied longer and stronger than they have here, and decide whether you want that to be the case here. I certainly don't. So...
Mm.
Scott.
Agreed.
Australian Christian Lobby. basically an article from Crikey exposing how there's all these so-called grassroots organisations. Marriage Alliance is one, Australian Marriage Forum, a Greek Orthodox website against same-sex marriage, and another site called You're Teaching Our Children What is a group, and goes on to explain that the fingers of the ACL are all over these so-called grassroots companies based on the website developers that they're using and their IP addresses and other things that you can pretty clearly see that... In terms of grassroots movements, they're the grass that's been well fertilised by the ACL.
Exactly.
So.
Yes, it has been well fertilised by the ACL. It's it is crazy that they've gone that far, but you know, it's nothing that we're not used to, really.
No, totally expected.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm. Fluoride in our water.
I find this incredible. Yeah.
The Mackay Council has just passed a resolution and they're going to take fluoride out of the water. And basically, because they have come under pressure from conspiracy theory lunacy... the head of the council who voted in favour of getting rid of the fluoride basically said he did it because that's what local public opinion is, even though that public opinion has been totally deluded by nutwing conspiracy theorists about fluoride. So it's really disappointing that... all the medical science points to fluoride being a great thing to help with the health of your teeth. No side effects that have been proven, other than a very minor one to do with discoloration of teeth sometimes. And, you know, this is a case where Labor made water fluoridation mandatory in 2007... but then the Liberal National Party, which must have been Campbell Newman...
it was, yeah.
...in 2012 gave them the options to opt out. and said, oh, local councils, if you want to get rid of fluoride, you can. And this article is saying, well, local councils don't know anything about public health and fluoridation. This is a health matter. And the current health minister, Cameron Dick, said on Wednesday, fluoridation was a matter for local government. Just wiped his hands of it. The Palaszczuk government isn't going to change the law. They're just going to let pokey little councils fall prey to nutbag conspiracy theorists about fluoridation. I mean, next we'll be banning planes from the sky because of chemtrails, Scott.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I found it ridiculous that Mackay would actually go and do that. You would expect fluoridation and that sort of stuff to be rejected by small tin pot councils, but Mackay's not a tin pot council. It's a reasonable size city up there, you know.
Well, no other state in Australia allows councils to do that, and here in Hicksville, Queensland, we've just let it happen.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's the US-based Centers for Disease Control and Prevention lists water fluoridization as among the 10 greatest public health achievements of the 20th century.
Mm.
You know, it's not everything the Third Reich did was wrong. You know?
Bit of authoritarianism from the top is what is needed.
Well, they were the first government to introduce fluoridation into the water.
Were they?
Oh. Yeah, they were.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's where part of the conspiracy theory comes from.
Oh.
Is that you've got anything the Third Reich did, obviously evil, and they did it to dumb you down and that sort of stuff and control the population.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh. Dear listener, we've all learnt something tonight, if only that. Scott, yeah. I've been saying for ages, we've got to get out of the Middle East. An article on John Menadou's blog saying, yes, we should.
We've got to get out.
This was from Andrew Farron, a former diplomat, former senior academic in public and international law. Some interesting things that he's come up with there. Yeah, just by staying there, we're compounding all the previous errors of judgment, breaches of law. But he says that we're involved in bombing a country that is recognised as a sovereign state without its invitation to do so. So we're in breach of the UN Charter with respect to acts of aggression. And in Iraq, we're there without a status of forces agreement, which would provide protection for our forces should they run into trouble under Iraq law. Indeed, the ploy adopted to avoid that has been to issue the Australian Defence Force personnel with diplomatic passports, Scott. Did you know that?
No, I had no idea until I read this that they got diplomatic passports.
Yeah. Because we're on such shaky legal ground being there that we've all of our soldiers in Iraq have got diplomatic passports. What are we doing there? And another thing about Section 61 and about, you know, powers to actually send people, it should have been done by the governor and council, but it's been done by the minister, and he's saying that's a breach of the constitution. But I like the final sort of conclusion he said is a line in the sand was drawn in the Middle East in 1914 as a colonial act. That line has been the cause of much conflict for over a century, but it is truly broken now. The remaking of the Middle East is a matter for the tribes, the religions, and the factions involved. We are not part of that and shouldn't be. We should get out. I agree.
I was originally in favour of the military intervention. I'm no longer. I think that there's plenty of evidence that has amassed over the last little while to say that we shouldn't be there, and it's only going to get worse.
Yep, and us being there,
I think we should get out.
Isn't going to help.
Hmm.
While I was on the John Menadou blog, I looked across to the right-hand menu, and to my delight, Scott, I saw an article. And what topic do you think it could be that could possibly give me delight?
Submarines?
Yes. Trust the John Menadue
blog. I've not read this one.
No, so you haven't. Go on. That's right. I was testing you, see. Great piece by John Stanford about the submarines. He's a director of Inside Economics. In a former life, he was head of the Industries Division in the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet. I mean, he knows a bit about how politics and works and government. Basically, he's put the subs at $4.6 billion, because we'd worked it out at $4.18, but he's got a $4.6 billion figure. Calls it an eye-watering price for a conventionally powered submarine. You know, most conventionally powered ones cost less than $1 billion. And we're paying $4.6 billion for each one. He said here, though, the proposal involves major technical challenges. Nobody has ever converted a nuclear submarine to conventional power before. Many submarine experts doubt that it can be done. The hull forms are different. The use of pump jet propulsion, which is a breakthrough technology in nuclear submarines, may not work in a conventionally powered one because of the lower speeds. And he's got this other thing here, which I hadn't heard of before. Air-independent propulsion, Scott. So, if you're in a conventionally powered submarine, you've got batteries in there, and you can charge those batteries, and you can swim around underwater for about 5 days. But then you've got to surface, and that's a really short time frame, and of course when you surface you become exposed to the enemy. So what conventionally powered submarines have is this air independent propulsion, which allows them to propel the submarine without surfacing. And there's various types of things, but they're enclosed systems where they might have oxygen in compressed tanks that they can use in a closed system to fire up a motor, if you like, and expel the fumes and whatever into the water. So so an air, and there's various different types of these things. So when your battery's running low, you can then resort to that. And the thing is, in nuclear subs, you don't have those systems. But in a conventional sub, you really need those systems. It's completely useless without it. He says that an air-independent propulsion is sine qua non, without which nothing, for an advanced conventionally powered sub in the 21st century. If you don't have it, you're just crazy, in your words, Scott. And the proposal for these submarines does not include air-independent propulsion.
Oh, you're joking. So we're paying four times the price for a sub that doesn't even have one of the basics.
So it'll be surfacing every 4 days rather than every 3 weeks. And every time it bobs up, you know, there you go.
It's going to be exposed to the enemy,
It's just... why are they doing this? He says one theory is that it's just a way of eventually getting a nuclear version of a submarine that, you know, a couple of years down the track, we're just going to go, oh, it's too hard to do all these conversions because of these things. We'll just have to make them nuclear. And it's a way of sort of getting a nuclear sub without having to go through the public debate over it. And he was speaking to a senior defence official who he quotes as saying... If you ask someone to devise a new submarine program with the highest risk factors at every stage, you could not have done a much better job. It will almost certainly end in tears and possibly a catastrophe.
Yeah, it's starting to look like we should have bought them from the Japanese.
Yep. Bought a nice, quiet, small, conventionally powered subs, 12 of them for about 600,000 each, and they could sit along the coastline.
600 million each.
600 million each. Sit along the northern coastline and, you know, pop off any convoy of troops headed our way. And, oh, gee, yeah, we wouldn't be able to participate in naval manoeuvres in the South China Sea. What a shame.
Well, yeah, I was listening to a podcast this afternoon, and I'm not convinced we should be involved in the South China Sea.
Of course we shouldn't be. We've got no business being in the South China Sea. We're not a superpower. America wouldn't want us there anyway.
The Americans could do whatever they wanted there anyway. Yeah. Without us.
Yeah. We could do with the money we're going to be wasting on those submarines, and they're not going to work. We're going to be actually worse off because they're just not going to work. They're going to be noisy. They're going to be coming up and burping for air. They're not going to be able to lie in wait and effectively shoot a convoy of troops coming from China or whatever. We're actually going to be left undefended because we're going to have these rusting hulks in some workshop in South Australia. And you can see it now.
South Australia's going to end up with an industry.
Scott, we've crossed a few countries off the list. I still haven't got that map, but we need to do it and put a little pin in each one that we cross off.
And Jordan's off the list, is it?
Jordan's off the list now, yeah. A prominent writer from the Christian family had the temerity to put a cartoon on his Facebook page, which his intention was to ridicule ISIS, but unfortunately for him, the religious groups took as mocking either Muhammad or Allah or both of them, and so he got charged with some sort of blasphemy charge and had all sorts of death threats. Family pleaded for protection, none was given, and he was gunned down on the steps of the courthouse as he had to appear for his court case. Yeah, with a bit of luck, I'll put that cartoon as the cartoon for on our Facebook when we put up this podcast, Scott. But,
yeah, I've seen the cartoon that got the guy in trouble. It's nothing. It really isn't anything. It's just a cartoon. That's all.
The poor guy immediately removed the cartoon, deactivated his Facebook account, apologised. Said he didn't mean to offend anybody, and met his fate in that country of Jordan. Crossed that one off the list, not going there. And
well, I've never planned on going there anyway, but still and all, it's probably one of those countries you want to cross off the flyover list to.
Pakistan has got so many crosses on it, Scott, that I've gone through the paper and hit the desk underneath. This time, a 16-year-old Christian boy merely liked a so-called inappropriate photograph on Facebook of the Kaaba in Mecca, and for that he's been jailed for blasphemy. 16-year-old boy likes an inappropriate photo of the Kaaba and he's thrown into jail.
Yeah, the Kaaba's the black box, isn't it?
That's right, yep.
Yeah.
That's the one that the 12th man said looked like a vagina, I think. So,
oh, yeah, it's got... yeah,
that,
I remember that.
Put that stone in the cornea. Yeah. So the 12th man better not go to Pakistan either. He'll
end up in trouble too, So that's really... Well, that's ruling out the Middle East for us, isn't it?
That's it. That's depressing from them.
Mm.
Scott, it gets even more depressing in New York.
New York?
Yes. This time, we've got a fashion show in New York, and the fashions put by this particular designer featured women wearing hijabs and standing ovation from the crowd in New York. for the bravery of the models and the designer to exhibit the the hijab on such a platform.
Yeah, so why would you give them a round of applause? Simply, you know, why a standing ovation?
Good question. Sarah Hyder says that the standing ovation was a celebration of women's oppression. And I think she's right.
She is right, yeah.
Yeah. So a bit on the hijabs. For most people who are wearing the hijabs, it's a religious signal meaning to show that you're abiding by old Islamic dictates of female modesty and newer dictates on how the modesty is displayed. But all of those dictates, new and old, were and are enforced by men. They're part of the corrosive patriarchy that pervades Islam. If the hijab makes you feel closer to God, then it is often does so by making you feel that you're adhering more closely to an entire code of conduct designed to oppress and marginalise women. I agree. So,
look, I agree too, yeah.
If you're wearing the hijab, you've been conned. Your religion does not require it. It's an oppressive garment imposed by a patriarchal system. If you're signalling that you're part of a tribe, then you are also signalling that you don't care about those women who are forced to wear it in other countries. So that audience, I reckon, who cheered were either cheering oppression, they were cheering themselves, how good are we, we're so tolerant and open-minded. Or maybe it's just a fashion show and they just cheer anything. Scott,
yeah, but you'd think that in New York that they would have a slightly more sophisticated think. You know, they'd be able to think about this sort of thing. And you'd think that, given what you know about New York, you'd think that they probably would be cheering the fact that they were wearing the hijab and that sort of stuff. And they're not just cheering because they've got a cheer. They're just cheering because of the garments that are up there. So, yeah.
So, you know, we're not saying to women, you know, you should be stopped from wearing the hijab. You should be stopped from wearing the burqa, but not the hijab. But that doesn't stop people like ourselves from criticising you for that choice. I mean, there are women in the world, millions of them, who are being forced to wear those garments, and you choose to wear one. Like, what sort of sisterhood is this? What sort of support and recognition of what those other women are going through?
Exactly. It's you're not clapping and that sort of stuff. You're not giving a standing ovation to one woman who is out there displaying an outward symbol of her faith. You are simply applauding the garment, which I find absolutely insulting to the millions of women in Saudi Arabia who are forced to wear the niqab in Saudi Arabia. You know, it's absolutely offensive to them.
I was trying to think of another example of where people were forced to wear a garment and you wouldn't celebrate that by wearing a garment yourself. And the only one I could come up at this stage was to try and give the example of the striped pyjamas that the Auschwitz prisoners were forced to wear. I mean, you wouldn't try and glamorise that. You wouldn't go around wearing the, you know, striped pyjamas of an Auschwitz prisoner. And why wouldn't you? Because to do so would be to celebrate that garment and that action and what happened. To the women of the world who are wearing the hijab and the burqa and the niqab, who don't have to, who are wearing it, you are celebrating what's being forced on other women.
Exactly.
So, yeah, a little bit of a risk of Godwin's law applying there. I've sort of almost a Nazi comparison, but I think I've managed to avoid it slightly. And still on the same topic, an article about a woman wearing a hijab in Playboy, no less. And she's being applauded for that. She's fully clothed wearing the hijab and the feminist left is saying how empowering this is. Again, you've just abandoned all of those women forced to wear it, and then you've gone and publicised a men's magazine that no feminist in their right mind should be applauding.
Yeah, exactly.
Goodness me, where has the feminist left gone when it starts applauding a woman wearing a hijab in Playboy? Like,
yeah.
If you were set that as a challenge 20 years ago or in the 60s, if you were to say that's going to happen, nobody would believe you. They wouldn't think possible.
Yeah.
They wouldn't think it's possible if you said, oh, one day a woman's going to wear an oppressive religious garment in a men's magazine and the feminists are going to say, well done, girl. Go, girl power.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh.
Yeah.
You've completely failed the sisterhood if you're in support of that.
Exactly.
Scott, Victorian Liberals are having a membership drive. And unfortunately...
Well, they should probably ditch their religious support, shouldn't they? Yeah.
Well, they're not. In fact, the membership committee, led by numbers man Marcus Bastian, he's out talking to churches, probus groups, retail traders, healthcare professionals, scouts groups, and anyone who will listen. And of course, he's having great success with the church groups and the ordinary non-religious or not so religious members of the Victorian Liberal Party are really concerned that it looks like some sort of stacking of the membership is occurring. They're going to fall foul of a Tea Party scenario here, the Conservative Party.
This is
They're allowing themselves to be taken over by the the Tea Party.
By the religious.
The Australian
by the
Tea
religious,
Party.
Yeah. And it's a small sect of the society that is taking over the Liberal Party, and that small sect is increasingly unpopular with the mainstream, and they're going to end up voting themselves out of office. You know, they're going to end up... because, you know, it's in New South Wales now, they've got a move. It's called to democratise the party. And all they're doing is they are moving in... they're talking about setting it up so that you're going to have more and more people involved, directly electing the members. What's the word I'm groping for?
The leader? No, not the leaders.
It's the local members. So it's going to be primaries and that sort of stuff. We'll end up selecting them.
Right.
Now, you've got to be a member of the party to vote in the primary.
Right.
And if the primary is voted on by members and the members are a majority Christian sect, then you're going to end up selecting as your candidate these right-wing radical Christians who will then fly over like a lead balloon in the public.
This is precisely what's happened in America, and it's been replicated.
That's exactly why Donald Trump got there.
Yep.
Well, no, he didn't. The main problem was that there was division and that sort of stuff in the early stages of the primaries. But you've got a situation that Donald Trump is, you know, he's applying to the religious groups to try and get his endorsements through. It's madness, anyway.
Yeah, so we've already mentioned Western Australia, where it was happening, and that's... I don't think I'd read about Victoria before, but you can see it happening, and they're so active and well-organised, and they will take over, if they haven't already. I mean, you can argue they have already, the Liberal Party.
Well, yeah, and, you know, myself and Deep Throat went to the book launch, as you know, and that was the overriding feeling I came away with when we walked out. Yep. I said to him, you know, they are ready for this, and he says, yeah, they are.
Yep.
You know, they are all beefed up, ready for the campaign and that sort of stuff, and they believe they can win it.
Yeah.
You know, it's a frightening proposition, but anyway.
Scott. One final article which I really liked, which I'm going to spend a bit of time on. So, dear listener, you know, we're going over the normal time here, but hey, I missed a week. I'm making up for lost time. This one is from a blog called Pandemonium, and the article is by this guy. He's a writer, lecturer, and broadcaster, and wrote a book, The Quest for a Moral Compass, A Global History of Ethics, Kenan Malik. And Scott, you probably didn't have time to get to this one, but it is really, really good. And I actually just posted on the Secular Party Facebook page, and I nearly put a sort of thing with the post to say, please don't comment unless you read the whole article, because it's really quite deep and it sort of annoys you sometimes when people make shallow comments about articles when they clearly haven't read it. So,
yeah.
But anyway, try and give you the gist of this article. And in a nutshell, it's talking about multiculturalism and how our thoughts of a broader society have now deteriorated into narrow interests of identity politics. It's kind of the theme of the article. So he talks about the failure of multiculturalism, and he says, you know, it's fashionable to criticise multiculturalism, but you've got to understand, he does a bit of definition setting up in terms of multiculturalism. So sort of two ways that multiculturalism should be understood. One is as a diversity in our society, and that's a good thing because it exposes us to ideas and stimulation. But the other meaning of multiculturalism is sort of the political process, policies which aim to manage diversity by putting people into ethnic and cultural boxes and keeping them in those boxes and keeping them separate from each other and championing the separation of people according to their identity as the other idea of multiculturalism. And so he's saying, of course, diversity is important, but he's critical of this other aspect that's promoting the separation of cultural groups. He says that the very valuable thing about diversity, it's important because it allows us to expand our horizons, to compare and contrast different values, beliefs, and lifestyles, to make judgments upon them, and to decide which may be better and may be worse. That makes sense. But the very thing about, that's valuable about diversity, the sort of tension and change, if you like, and conflict, is precisely what many people fear. And there's two sort of responses or forms of that fear. One response is a sort of a nativist sentiment where, as the majority, you don't want the minority coming in and changing things. And the other approach is what he calls indifference, where the otherness of migrants, for example, as an issue is that society must simply respect and live with. That we don't criticise or challenge their values or practices, but instead police the boundaries between the groups. So our response to that sort of tension of diversity is either to, if you're in the majority, to be very wary of change to your majority position, or potentially to encourage the segregation of those groups to limit conflict. He says that in the past, there was more of a universalist viewpoint that we were working towards, where the aim was not to protect one's own special culture, but to create a more universal culture in which all could participate on equal terms. That's what I think, Sir Scott, that the secular party tries to do, is we're just trying to look at society as a whole, rather than these various minor cultural groups, and what's the best thing for society as a whole.
Yeah, exactly.
In recent decades, though, the universalist viewpoint has eroded. The social space vacated by that disintegration has been filled by identity politics. As the broader struggles for social transformation have faded, people have tended to retreat to their particular faiths or cultures and to embrace more parochial forms of identity. So rather than looking at what's good for our society, people are just retreating to, well, what's good for my tribe, my group, my culture, whether that's religious or racial or whatever it is. You know, the schools thing we were talking about earlier with the private schools funding and that, it's what's good for my tribe is what's driving those people. Instead of what's good for our society. What society do we want in 100 or 200 years? People aren't taking that generalist, universalist approach. They've reverted back to their in-groups. So he says there, in recent years, the answer to the question, in what kind of society do I want to live, has become shaped less by the kinds of values or institutions people want to struggle to establish than by group or tribe which we imagine we belong to. And for the question, who are we, it's become defined less by the kind of society they want to create than by the history and heritage to which supposedly they belong. People's sense of belonging has become more narrow and parochial, moulded less by the possibilities of transformative future than by an often mythical past. Goes on to say, what matters in political struggles is not who you are, but what you believe. The reverse is true in cultural or ethnic struggles. And that's a bit of an explanation of Donald Trump, in that he is... it's getting the evangelical vote. The evangelical section is supporting Donald Trump. And basically because he says, I'm in your tribe, I'm with you guys, I support and I'm an evangelical. When all of the evidence is totally to the contrary.
Exactly, yes.
But people would say, well, he's my tribe, I'm going for the Donald.
Exactly.
That's what he's relying on, where people are not looking at, well, A, they're not caring about society in general, they're just caring about their tribe, the evangelical tribe, and that's really shut out their inquiring as to whether this guy is actually favourable for the evangelical tribe or not. He's, like, you wouldn't believe a word he says about his faith and all the rest of it. It's simply made up for the purposes of getting elected. But yeah, if the person's my tribe, then I'm for them, and it's not so much what they say about the rest of society. So that's that part there. And another part here, so he calls this process the cultural turn, this change from an overall what's best for society to more of a parochial look. He calls this cultural turn. Has encouraged us to repose political problems as issues of culture or ethnicity or faith, and so transform political conflicts into forms that make them neither useful nor resolvable. Rather than ask, what are the social roots of racism and what structural changes are required to combat it? A multicultural approach demands recognition for one's particular identity, public affirmation of one's cultural difference, and respect and tolerance for one's cultural and faith beliefs. And I just read that and I just thought, that's our whole Aboriginal dilemma in, how are we going to ever fix the problem that we have with Aboriginal communities in remote parts of Australia? And we don't ask what are the social
roots of racism and structural change that are required here. We just get bogged down in people wanting to recognise identity, well, public affirmation of their culture, and tolerance for one's cultural and faith beliefs. And it stops a societal response to things. Scott, all sound good so far?
Yeah, it does. And I think I agree with him.
So basically, these multicultural policies do not, in practice, get rid of conflicts, but transform political and ideological struggles into cultural and communal clashes. I like that.
So. I think that's valid. I think we have concentrated too much on what divides us rather than what unites us when it comes to multiculturalism.
And I just, you know, you just see so much of something like Q&A, for example, will be so much about people's identity and culture in a group rather than what as a society do we need to be doing to be fixing
exactly.
this.
Yeah.
Sense. So, so I found that a really, really good article. I'll keep that one in the top drawer. So, Scott, we've gone over time, but we've got a mountain of articles for next week.
We do have a mountain of articles to get through for next week, yes.
Dear listener, views expressed in this program, not necessarily those of the Secular Party. If you want to know what they are, visit the website and have a look. We're on 100 likes, Scott, and we have been for
quite a while. Yes, we did make it to 100 likes, to 100.
Tell your friends, share, that would be helpful, and doing a bit of a drive for membership over the Secular Party over the next few weeks. If you see that, sign up, that would be good. And otherwise, Scott, that's enough from me, and we'll be back next week.
That's enough from me too, so thank you very much, and thank you very much for listening, and we'll talk to you next week.
Bye, bye now. Well, dear listener, did you enjoy that episode of the podcast? If you did, I've got a favour to ask. First up, tell some friends. Let them know about the podcast. You'll be discussing something at some time, and you might be repeating something I've said. And when you're talking to your friends, say, hey, I heard this on this podcast, and it's worth listening to. And maybe pick an episode that you think's a good one and direct them to it. Like, grab their phone and go to their podcast app and search for Iron Fist Velvet Glove and subscribe on their behalf on their phone and just put the word out. The other thing is you could become a patron and support the show. So if you go to our website, you'll see a link to Patreon, and there are some different options for subscribing and paying per episode. And really the amount that you pay depends on what you get from the podcast. So there's different levels ranging from $1.50 Australian to, I think, $10 and various ones in between. It's really, what do you think it's worth? Is it worth a cup of coffee? Is it worth more than that, less than that? Whatever you get out of it, because not everybody gets the same. Maybe you don't listen to the whole thing. Maybe you never talk about it with people. Maybe you really couldn't care less half the time whether the podcast is there. It just, it'll be different for everybody. So if you get a lot out of the podcast, contribute a bit more. If you don't get much, contribute less. But in any event, you can subscribe there. If you don't like the idea of a regular subscription, the website has a link to a PayPal donation. So you could just do a one-off donation every now and again. So there you go. It'd be good to spread the word, get a few more listeners. And that way, look, if we ended up getting more listeners and more money, we could do maybe a second episode or more special episodes, provide some more content. So it's up to you. If you think it's worthwhile, let people know. Thanks.